Welcome to Friend of Maryland. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Maryland, I share some of my favorite fat things. I chat with Jeanette DePatty, aka The Fat Chick, and I spotlight a blog from Dances with Fat. Welcome to another edition of My Favorite Fat Things. First of all, I was very excited to find in the mail a few days ago a body positive coloring book by Nicole Lorenz called Fat Ladies in Space. Now, this is so cool for so many reasons. First of all, it's an adult coloring book, which just rocks. And second of all, it's an adult color book that is full of pictures of fat ladies in space. There are all kinds of fat ladies in space in this coloring book. And I'm quite excited about the damage I'm going to do with my crayons. I might not even stay in the lines. I strongly recommend that anyone who enjoys getting their color on, check it out. And of course, it's just always fun to have something like this on your shelf to refer to. I do believe this is my first coloring book that has ever had a positive depiction of a fat person in it. And that makes me really excited. Something else that makes me really excited is the news from Substantia Jones at Adipositivity that there will be a calendar for 2012. It's available now for sale at Cafe Press. And I do believe I recognize Charlotte Cooper as March. I've ordered mine. I ordered one for my mom. I'm super excited for those to come in so I can ring in 2012 in Fatlicious style. Another great thing coming out for 2012 is the Fatso Day Planner. Marilyn Wan has put this together, and it is being sold by Volumptu Art. If you've never gone to Volumptu Art, Volumptuart, I highly recommend it. It is a fat-positive website where you can get all sorts of things from cards to art to clothes. So it's where you get your 2012 Fatso Day Planner. Quite excited about this. I know that Marilyn has put a lot of work into it, and she has utilized the best talents and gifts that she can find, including the work of other fat activists and other fat artists and other fat scholars in the field. I know she asked me for a quote, and I'm super excited to get my day planner. Lots of other exciting things on the horizon. One thing that was recently brought to my attention is that at the 2012 annual meeting of the Association of American Geographers, which is being held in New York this year, there's going to be a session called Size Matters, Theorizing and Researching the Embodied Geography of Size. Here's the abstract for that session. Quote, "These sessions draw together papers that considered the varied ways that body size and the sizing of bodies matter to geographical research and knowledge production. This interest builds upon recent critical work in the discipline that has developed empirical and theoretical accounts of bodies that are sized, including works on fatness and obesity, and more broadly work that is considered the social size of bodies in order to interrogate the intersection of bodily size with other social categories of difference and processes of exclusion. A focus on the geographies of bodily size and sizing, therefore, provides an opportunity to consider the wide-ranging lived experiences and materialities of differently sized bodies and parts of bodies. For example, Longhurst has called for more research to consider in more depth the fluid spatiotemporalities of embodied size, bodies that grow, shrink, etc., and thus to explore the immaterialities of bodily dimension and scale. Moreover, an attention to body size also demands a critical interrogation of where, when, and how sized bodies and parts of bodies are measured, regulated, represented, discriminated, celebrated, and so on. This could include considering those technologies, such as medical, internet, social media, and practices, such as clothing, surgery, and body modification, involved in the production of sized bodies and parts of bodies, policy interventions, contemporary and historical representations of sized bodies, body size employment legislation, and size-oriented activism," end quote. Doesn't that abstract sound amazing? How I wish I could get to New York February 24th through 28th to go to this conference. Within that session are papers by Robin Longhurst, Aaron Pritchard, Zoe Melio-Irwin, Nicole Mixon-Perez, Rachel Coles, Bethann Evans, and many others. So if you're in that area or can get to that conference, I strongly recommend it. If making it to New York is definitely not in your cards for 2012, perhaps coming to New Zealand is. I'm quite excited to announce that I will be hosting a Fast Studies conference at my university, Massey University, on our Wellington campus. The title of the conference is Fat Studies, Reflective Intersections, and I hope to see many of my listeners there. There's a website, although it's still being built, which is fs2012.massey.ac.nz. I will be putting out a call for posters soon, and I'm super excited to announce that my keynote speaker is Dr. Samantha Murray from Macquarie University. Joining me today is Jeanette DePatty, aka The Fat Chick, a fat licensed aerobics instructor and author of the new book, The Fat Chick Works Out. Jeanette, thank you so much for joining me today on Friend of Marilyn.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I have to admit, you're the first person that I've ever had on that's going to talk about kind of exercise and working out. So this is a new area for the show. But just to kind of kick us off, like, what inspired you to write a book called The Fat Chick Works Out?
I think it's really important to separate the idea of fitness from the idea of weight loss. A lot of people engage in fitness purely because they think that they're going to lose weight. Mm. And for a lot of people, those two things, exercise and weight loss, are almost synonymous or interchangeable. But in the real world, they don't always go together. Some people exercise a little bit and lose a bunch of weight, and some people exercise a whole lot and don't lose any weight. And so I think a lot of people tie the idea of success in fitness, success in exercise, with weight loss, but that's not really the case. That's not the marker for success.
So what would you say the marker for success is?
Well, the marker for success is to pick a kind of exercise, A, that you like and is fun for you, and B, that is at a level that is comfortable for your body, so that C, you can sustain it over time. Because the real goal of exercise is to start exercising and stay exercising your whole life. That's when you get the health benefits that come with fitness. So that's how I like to frame success.
So I know this might seem like a silly question, but there might be people out there who are wondering, well, aren't the health benefits associated with weight loss? And if you don't lose weight when you exercise, are there health benefits?
Well, actually, that's a really good question. And a lot of people think that when you exercise and lose weight, that the health benefits come from the weight loss part. But there's actually a lot of studies that have been done and a lot of statistics that have been gathered by folks like the Cooper Institute for Aerobics and other researchers that show that the fitness is what gives you the health benefits, whether or not you lose weight. So even if you don't lose a single pound, you're still getting the health benefits that come from exercise. And those health benefits are really across a wide spectrum.
Could you identify some of those health benefits for us?
Sure. I mean, you know, if exercise could be taken in a pill, every person in the country would take this pill, because exercise really does amazing things for you. It improves your cardiovascular health. It helps you sleep better. It helps you manage stress. It makes you less susceptible to depression. And it helps you handle depression if you have that situation. It gives you a better sex life. It makes you feel better about yourself. It helps prevent disease. It strengthens your immune system. And all in all, it's a pretty amazing thing in how it helps your body, just from top to bottom.
So why, though, specifically, like, in your work that you do and, like, in the book that you've titled, are you specifically kind of targeting in the sense of fat people? So do fat people have different considerations they need to make before they exercise?
Well, my book isn't really targeted just at fat people. I mean, that's why it's called The Fat Chick Works Out instead of The Fat Chick Workout, right?
Ah, I see.
Right, because I'm a fat chick and I'm working out and I'm helping other people work out. But you don't have to be a fat chick to do this workout. Where I focus my book and the DVD and the website is at people who are new to exercise. Maybe they haven't exercised in a long time. Maybe they've never exercised. And I focus on helping people find a safe and fun and happy way to get started. And then once they've started, to stick with it. So that's my area of expertise.
Do you find that whether or not people actually, as you said, stick with it, so whether or not they stick with an exercise program, how connected is that to the motivations they had when they started?
Well, it can be very connected, and that is an important part of my work. That, you know, because a lot of people would say, well, if you tell them that they're going to lose weight and it gets them started, you know, even if you know that's a lie, what's the harm? Mm. Well, the harm is that sticking to fitness has a lot to do with expectation management, right? So if you set yourself up with goals that you aren't going to meet, you're going to feel like a failure and you're not going to stick with it. And this is not what we want. If you tell somebody, hey, if you work out 15 minutes a day, you're going to look like Angelina Jolie. And then, you know, they work out 30 minutes a day and they look like Angela Lansbury. They're like, well, clearly this isn't working. Clearly I'm a failure. That's why it's really important to help set expectations that people have a reasonable chance of meeting, because success breeds success. So if I tell people, hey, you know, if you work out 20 minutes a day, or 20 minutes three times a week, let's say that's where we're going to start. That's where you, that's where your starting place is. And you know what? You're going to start feeling pretty good about that. And I think if you really focus on what your body feels like from day to day, you'll start noticing some positive changes. Well, first of all, I'm setting a goal that they can meet. And second of all, I'm directing them inward to noticing what changes are happening in their body, because the changes aren't the same from person to person. I mean, one person can have a totally different experience than the other person. But I just say, hey, just show up. Just do it. And you'll be amazed at how different you feel. But I don't tell them, well, you're going to lose 12 inches off your waist, or you're going to drop 2 dress sizes, because I don't know what that effect is going to be. And if I promise them something and then they don't get it, you know, like if your mom says, hey, if you do this, you can go to a movie, and then you do it, and she's like, nah, not so much. Well, you're going to be annoyed, right? You're going to be like, well, the next time your mom says do this, you're going to be like, nah, not so much. So I think it's really important to promise people things that are true and then be ready to back those promises up and follow through.
Well, and I really appreciate your message about, or the work that you do trying to separate the idea of fitness from weight loss, because I think that one of the assumptions that a lot of people have, and of course it's damaging for both fat and non-fat bodies, is the idea that people who aren't fat must be regularly exercising, because we all know that fat people are fat because they're not, you know, so it's that assumption. Right. And of course, what the literature tells us is actually that's not true, is that, you know, fat people and non-fat people alike both engage in the same amount of exercise, and actually of non-exercise is what most of it finds. Mm-hmm. So the idea of supporting exercise for the health benefits instead of for weight loss would, you know, encourage more people of all shapes and sizes of their bodies to say, oh, if this is something I'm interested in, regardless of if I'm fat or not fat, then exercise is something that could be beneficial.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, one thing that is important is there's a lot of research that shows that all things else being equal, a fat person who exercises is going to live longer than a thin person who does not exercise. So by not encouraging thin people to exercise, we're doing them a disservice.
Right, yeah.
By assuming that the fat people don't exercise, we're doing them a disservice. And also, you know, I think a lot of times a person who hasn't exercised in a long time, you know, they go to a gym and a trainer sees them and they're like, well, this person is fat and I got to get them the weight off of them. and they put them on a program that's way too hard and way too fast, and then they get hurt, they get injured, they, you know, their entire life is turned upside down because they can't walk the next day. And the person says, well, forget it. If this is what fitness is, I can't do it. And the truth is, everybody can do fitness at some level. Everybody can engage in physical activity. The key is to find the level that's appropriate for your body, where you are right now. Not necessarily where you were in high school, you know, 25 years ago, but where your body is right now. That's where you need to start. And you can go amazing places making very gradual changes over time.
So if there's someone listening to the show right now who currently isn't involved in any kind of movement and who is interested in becoming involved in different ways of moving their body, what would be the first step you would recommend that they take?
Well, the first thing, of course, they need to do is buy my book. Because
yeah. Oh, of course. Sorry. How can I be so silly?
No. The first thing that they need to do is to start with a very gentle assessment of where their body is at that time. So on my website at www.thefatchick.com, in the tools section, there's something called the Rock the Block tool. And that's a tool where it's a description of an exercise where you just basically walk around a block, and then you see how you feel, and you walk around the block again. And you might walk around the block 20 times, or you might walk around the block one time. It just depends on where your body is. And you say, okay, you sort of put that marker in the sand. This is my starting spot. And then you just want to not increase more than 10% per week. So let's say we're going to do duration. And if I'm doing 10 minutes this week, then next week I would do not more than 11 minutes because it's 10% increase per week.
Uh-huh.
But you can start, like, way, way back when I started in this fitness channel, I started out with just walking very gradually, you know, 2 or 3 days a week for 20 to 30 minutes. And within a year and a half, I worked myself up to a marathon. So you can go, you know, that 10% per week, that adds up. So you can really go a long way. But if I had started out with the idea that, okay, no matter where my body is now, I'm going to do 15 miles a week, I would have done that for 4 weeks. I would have gotten injured. In fact, the first time I tried to do a marathon, that's exactly what happened. I did it for 3 weeks. I got injured, and then I stopped because I couldn't move anymore. So it's way better to start small and just gradually increase and stay with it. That's how you get there in the end.
So you would encourage people of all sizes to buy your book?
I do. It's really not just for fat people. And even if you are exercising now, there's a lot of information in there about how to stay motivated and how to fly over, around, and through the obstacles that are keeping you from sticking to your exercise routine. So there's a lot in there for exercises at almost any level.
Well, excellent. Jeanette, thank you so much for coming on the show today and talking about your work as the Fat Chick. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
In the spotlight today is a blog from Dances with Fat. This blog is written by Reagan Chastain, who has been a guest on the show before, and I'm pretty sure I've lit something that she's written in the past. She's one of my favorite bloggers, and she writes really good stuff. The blog we're spotlighting today is called I See Fat People. They're everywhere. Quote, about that whole obesity epidemic thing, Australian scholar Michael Gard points out in his new book, The End of the Obesity Epidemic, that over the last decade, obesity rates among both adults and children have leveled off or declined all over the world, including in the United States. In 1998, 35 million Americans went to bed a healthy weight and woke up fat, thanks to a commission of scientists with ties to weight loss programs and drugs who successfully lobbied to have what is considered a, quote, healthy weight lowered. But try to calmly enter this information into the discussion, and you'll often find yourself shouted down by people yelling, I see fat people everywhere, and I didn't before. 65% of people are fat, and it's growing. I see fat people everywhere, and they are, well, fill in the blank with a negative stereotype. This may be a good time to remember that observation, while part of the scientific method, is not science in itself. And here's why. First, there's a principle called confirmation bias, which explains that people tend to favor information that confirms their preconceptions or hypothesis, regardless of whether or not the information is true. They also tend to interpret ambiguous results as supporting their point of view. Interestingly, this is why it took me so long to choose a behavior-centered health approach. I was certain that I had to lose weight to be healthy, and it took a while for the facts that were staring me in the face to set in. But back to our world overrun with fatties. We must accept the possibility that it's not that there are a ton more fatties, or that every fatty fits into negative stereotypes, but rather that our confirmation bias is driving us to seek out evidence to support our conclusion and ignore that which does not. Similarly, when someone posts a comment on one of my dance videos saying how lazy I am, they are ignoring the evidence in front of them because they are letting their confirmation bias run away unchecked, or because they're a jackass. And actually, the two aren't mutually exclusive. At any rate, this is something that we all have to be aware of, especially if we are reviewing and interpreting data. The second issue is frame of reference. I've heard more than one doctor say, "I know that obesity causes health problems. Every obese person I see has health problems." Well, you're a doctor. Do a lot of people stop by your office to say that they feel great? When told my story about being a healthy, active fat woman, a therapist specializing in binge eating disorder told my friend that it's my experience that someone that size probably has binge eating disorder. Well, perhaps that's because her experience is with fat people coming to her to deal with binge eating disorder. It's like a podiatrist saying that every person with feet has foot problems. If all you've got is a hammer, every problem can start to look like a nail. Next, we have sample size. Your cousin's fat wife, who eats nothing but McDonald's, does not a statistically significant sample size make. You can't use one or a few people to draw conclusions about the world of fat people. If you or your sister-in-law's best friend's nanny's aunt lost weight and kept it off for 5 years, then you are a statistical anomaly. If you were on TV, the bottom of the screen would read, "Results not typical." You are not proof that weight loss works for the majority or even the minority of people. The next thing to think about is meaning. Even if it's true that there are tons more fat people than there used to be, do we know, and I'm not talking about the whole everybody knows, I'm talking about evidence-based knowing, why it's happening or what it even means? We are also taller than we used to be, but nobody's freaking out about the tallness epidemic. The hysteria around obesity and its healthcare costs, which, despite popular opinion, have been shown to be minimal, have somehow made it okay to skip the steps where we look dispassionately at why a phenomenon happens and what it means. And instead, we've jumped right to, "We're going to die. We're going to die. Quick, shame the fatties." Finally, we have to look deeper. I heard someone say the other day that they were at the hospital and most of the people there were fat, thus proving that fat people are less healthy. All of the issues from above apply, but let's even look deeper. According to research out of Yale University, in this culture, fat people have a more than 50% chance that when we go to the doctor, she or he will view us and treat us as if we are awkward, unattractive, lazy, weak-willed, and unlikely to comply with treatment. Even when fat people do go to the doctor, they are often humiliated and receive subpar care. Without so much touching us, let alone using proper diagnostics, doctors diagnose us as fat, give us a treatment protocol of weight loss, and send us on our way. People have relayed in studies having been prescribed weight loss without even being touched by their doctor for sudden onset intense back pain that turned out to be ruptured discs, abdominal pain that turned out to be cancer, and abdominal pain that turned out to be gallstones that required emergency surgery. So many fat people have four horrible experiences that lead to them avoiding the doctor, and when we go, we often get subpar treatment. Both of these things can lead to us not getting proper early intervention, thus finding us in the hospital for situations that a thin person would have had solved by their doctor in its early stages because they were listened to with proper respect and given a treatment plan based on proper diagnostics. You can't just accept things at face value if you want to get to the truth. You have to ask yourself, is the statement true? If it is true, what might it mean? Observation can be powerful, but we have to be careful about drawing large-scale conclusions based only on what we can see. This is something that researchers struggle mightily with. You know how when you paint a room, the painting is easy, but the setup is a pain? All that taping and prepping, laying down the tarp, etc. That's how setting up research is. Actually performing the research is the easy part. The difficult part is in setting it up, making sure that you have a statistically significant sample size, extrapolable to the population of interest, deciding what variables to control for and how to control for them, etc. Good researchers go to great pains to do this well, and they always state their limitations, so it's foolish to think that we can just look around and get information that's just as good. Unquote. Thanks for listening to Friend of Maryland. You can contact the show by emailing friendofmaryland@aol.com. Tune in next week only on Access Manawatu, 9:99 a.m. Closing the show is Adele with Cold Shoulder.